Hello all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. Repeat listeners know this isn't your everyday Lit Crit pod. In fact, 9 out of 10 doctors agree subscription to Book Spider does not negatively impact liver function in most adults. It may even save your life. My name is Chris Malmberg, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. As always, we will discuss questions we have about today's book. We will also attempt to draw connections between today's book and other books we've covered on the podcast. Today we're discussing Then We Came to the End by Joshua Ferris. Set largely in 2001 during the dot-com crash, it follows the professional foibles of some creatives who work as part of a large team in an advertising firm that is rapidly failing, resulting in ongoing layoffs. Fear of losing their jobs fans the flames of office drama, culminating at one point with a fired employee returning to the office in a clown suit to shoot up the place with a paintball gun. Several potential clients emerge later in the novel, but the creatives are unable to save any of their own jobs. As plot summaries go, that is sort of a vast simplification, but also that's basically what happens. The novel is very episodic and likes to jump around in time, but if we are going to really come to the end, everyone loses their jobs, some people don't move on, and others do. There are a bunch of characters and several arcs I could describe in more detail, but I think the most important one to note is Lynn Mason, who is everyone's boss. Mason is dying of ovarian cancer, and the novel briefly breaks from its established POV to tell a version of her story. Perhaps the most important thing to describe about the book is the central device of the novel, the thing that really makes it stand out, and that is, it's told in the first person plural, from the perspectives of the creatives as a group, rather than any one perspective individually. It's a we novel, which is pretty rare. So, I will start off with getting your general impressions of the novel. Hans, Patrick, what did you think?
Well, this was a reread for me. I think you and I both read it in the same class in grad school. And, you know, it's something that I had a lot of respect for at the time while not really kind of connecting with personally. And, yeah, that's about how I felt about it now, I would say. I mean, it is very, very good, right? Like it's everything is in its right place. It's thematic enough. It's you know, got some emotional, it's got some emotional content, but it's not melodramatic. The central device that you mentioned, the first person plural, is very creative and very you know, it's formally very distinct in that regard. There's something so tidy about it that I can't quite bring myself to love it. And I was even, you know, reading it this time, the last 10 or 15 pages, I found myself actually very moved. I was having a lot of, you know, I had a lot of feeling for the characters and for the kind of, there's a thing that happens where in the last sentence of the novel where, spoiler alert, I guess, but like the novel ends with everybody going to a reading of a novel, which is basically this novel, right? There's kind of like a little bit of meta inversion where one of the characters writes this novel. And everybody goes to that meeting, and it's a reunion of all the people who've been fired from this failing ad agency. And it ends with everybody leaving, and then the last two words are, now it's just you and me. And that whole kind of bit of all the people drifting away and kind of the core... you know, second person changing to first person. I found that unaccountably moving, even though 90% of the reread, I had thought, well, this is fine enough, but it's just a little too It's not weird enough. It's not messy enough. It's not shocking enough. It's really quite good, but not off in the way that things are off that really kind of get into your heart, you know?
Patrick?
Needed more direct, didactic denunciation of capitalism.
It does come up.
No. That was just a joke, you know.
I was thinking about that, actually. I'm sure we'll come back to that, but I can actually see that as, I mean, you know, it might be one of those things where, like, you're criticizing the book for not doing a thing it didn't set out to do, but I do remember thinking, like, I mean, this book was published in, I think, 2007, and you could not write and publish this book in 2020 to, like, a literary audience, which is implicitly left-wing, without making it much more critical of capitalism, right? Like, you can read it as being in some ways critical of capitalism, but not really, I don't think. Anyway, sorry, I kind of hijacked your response there, but go ahead.
No, that's all right. I mean, you know, I always like it when, you know, well... You know, I know I was originally joking, but when I think about it, this is like the perfect setup to do, to just follow from what you're saying, Hans. This is kind of the perfect setup to have a reasonably good book that looks at, looks in depth at capitalist exploitation in the workforce, in the workplace, in a reasonably interesting, ironic, and fun way. And it's not, I would say that I don't think that is in, like, we certainly, you know, we talk about capitalism a lot in, on the left and in literary works and all that. We do talk about capitalism. But one thing that we don't specifically talk about enough is actually the employer-employee dynamic and relationship, which is kind of at the heart of capitalism and at the heart of what most Marxists and anarchists are pissed about. So this could have been a good venue for a critique along those lines. That being said, you know, I enjoyed this. I thought it was fun. I could see a lot of my own office experience in this novel. Like, you know, I remember when I was working in an office a couple years ago, like, I would initiate rubber band fights, you know, for fun, to waste time. And, like, they became a huge thing, like, for, like, a month. It became a pretty huge thing to have rubber band fights every day. So I definitely see that. I liked the Lynn Mason storyline. You know, that was probably my favorite part where we narrow in on someone and get like a nice empathetic reading of this contradictory character who is, you know, strong, bossy, but, you know, is terrified of the doctor, to the point that she dies. On the topic of the ending, where one of the characters, you said, Hans, writes this novel, I hadn't necessarily thought of it in a meta way. I don't tend to do that, just because, like, meta is not at the top of my mind most of the time. But I didn't think he was writing this novel. I thought he was writing a novel of his experiences in the office, you know, based on the office
that
he worked in.
Just when I said he was writing this novel, the scene where he does the reading, there is a quote from his novel, and I found that quote in this novel. So,
right.
I mean,
I guess
I mean,
guess
I don't know
I'm,
if
I'm not
I don't
saying...
know if the whole thing lines up, but like the thing he reads is literally text from the novel we are reading.
Right. I'm not saying that I we could have a deeper conversation about it. My reaction to that was it was simply a device to say to tell the reader, hey, he's writing from his own experiences. He's writing about these characters. But the fact you could probably pull that off without doing a word for word quote from an earlier part of the novel. So maybe you're right. I don't know. Whatever. Meta's not super interesting to me. So, if it is meta, whatever.
Well, and it's not like, I don't think, to the extent that it is meta, I think it's just kind of like meta in a passing joke sort of way. Whatever kind of recursion happens here, I don't think is really of any kind of important thematic or structural weight. It's just kind of, are you sharp enough to catch this? Ha ha. And that's about it, really.
Right. I'll tell you, I thought it was actually, my initial thought was it was just the chapter that we had about Lynn Mason, because that chapter breaks the point of view of the novel away from the we. And that makes sense in the context of the we, if that collective we knows the story through his reading. So basically, that's the first chapter of a story that, because they ask him about the novel, and he says it's about Lynn in part. And it could go either way. I don't think there's a right answer. But in a way, it felt like a trick for basically legitimizing that chapter where we follow Lynn, and it isn't told from the perspective of a we, because that is maybe actually the very beginning of Hank, the novelist's work. And so it's sort of like Hank is telling that story to the rest of the we, which is actually something that we get throughout the novel, is this we, this collective mind, hears the stories of individual members of the we and also non-members of the we, who hears those stories, and then it's kind of like amalgamated into a story of what's going on around it. And the interesting thing about that is that it's really unreliable. Lynn Mason dies of ovarian cancer, but in Hank's story and in the understanding of the we, she has breast cancer. There's many instances actually throughout where the narrator, the we, insists on its own like knowledge. It knows everything, but is actually confused all the time and not aware of everything. So that meta quality, that game, I thought was really fascinating. I thought it was kind of clever. But I could also see it as a little bit unnecessary and a little bit insufferable to insert that at the very end, like a little kind of wink to, Hans, to, like you said, to those who are paying close enough attention. But I liked it.
Yeah, I liked it well enough. I mean, I don't know. I think to some extent, and I don't mean to be critical of your line of questioning here. To some extent, I think maybe I'm wrong, but it seems a little bit like, I hate these sort of cliches, but paying way too much attention, like not seeing the forest for the trees to really get too much into the nitty-gritty of kind of the meta relationships between the book and the book in the book. And, to your question of, is the we narrator actually unreliable, because there's the idea that Lynn has breast cancer, but actually she dies of ovarian cancer. I guess I read that as just being bad luck, essentially, right? Like, she beats the breast cancer and then a couple years later has ovarian cancer, because the main action of the novel ends in 2001, September 2001. And we might talk a little bit at some point, if we can remember to come back to it, about the way that 9/11 is kind of built up to and then pulled away from, because that actually resonates with a couple of books that we read a few years ago. But then, you know, the end where everybody's coming back together for the reading, that's in 2006, right? So my assumption was just that she had beat the breast cancer in 2001 and then gotten ovarian cancer at some point in the mid-2000s and died of that, unfortunately. It was less a matter of a misunderstanding and just she had two different types of cancer over the course of six
years.
That's
also how I read it, just to chime in.
I like the idea... I like the idea. I like the idea of there being subtle hints that the collective is wrong, but there are just too many breast-focused details in the section from her point of view, right? I don't know.
Well,
I mean.
The her point of view. That's Hank's novel. That's a fictionalization of what actually happens to Lynn.
Like, but if that's
that
the case,
belong
then
to Lynn.
If that's the case, though, then, I mean, that implies that all the third-person retellings are reconstructions by an unreliable middleman, right? Like, if that's true of Lynn, if that's true of the third-person section of Lynn, I mean, essentially, once we shift into Lynn's POV, it remains close third person for the rest of the novel. We just begin moving between different close third person perspectives, and we're to understand that all of those are, but the thing is, though, if we're to understand that all of those are unreliable reconstructions, then everything in the novel is an unreliable reconstruction, and then the ground, the rug has been pulled so firmly that we just kind of end up back where we started, don't we?
Maybe we can kind of like keep it in mind and move on to my next question, which is kind of directed at what this novel made me think of. And I think that maybe this will speak back to it. I'm not sure. But this novel reminded me of Catch-22. Both are playing with the absurd behavior of characters as framed by specific environments. Catch-22 obviously is World War II. Then we came to the end is an office building. They also both satirize those worlds. In Then We Came to the End, you know, we have the equivalent of rubber band fights, Patrick, but also just the gossip, the kind of mob right. mentality, the Is the word zeitgeist the wrong word? Is this like a mini zeitgeist of a discrete number of people?
I don't know, why not.
This group of creatives and their understanding of what's, you know, going on around them, and also just the various things that they get distracted by, care about. Both Catch-22 and Then We Came to the End are pretty episodic. Sometimes repetitive and very funny. And I was curious, maybe we start with this, you know, critique question and go from there. Catch-22, when we talked about it, we admired the work of the editor while acknowledging the fact that Catch-22 is this big kind of shaggy mess. And I kind of felt a little bit similarly about Then We Came to the End, even though it is very tidy in what it sets out to accomplish and what it does accomplish. It also felt like it accomplished that by repeating certain gestures, by having certain things that were sort of a type happen, you know, multiple times. And I actually kind of like, there was a kind of a, a sequence that, or a cycle where, you know, a character would sort of, one of the we would be sitting with the rest of the we and would reference something that happened in the past. And then we'd go into the past with that person and learn of what happened through that person's perspective. And that sort of, that cycle repeating itself, I don't know, it felt a bit like a trick, like it's sort of a device. And it kind of lulled me into, not in an unenjoyable, but a kind of a, I don't know, I felt like it didn't really need to spend as much time doing what it was doing. And ultimately, I felt like then we came to the end, could have been edited down, but I'm not sure that I would want it to be. And all of that kind of occurred to me when Patrick mentioned in the lead up to this podcast that there is an edited version, an abridged version. It's really the only audiobook version available on Audible. And I was curious about your guys' sense of the novel as a kind of something, you know, as an attempt to accomplish something by Joshua Ferris. And are the things that it's accomplishing things that it could accomplish in a more economical way? Is there, is that too reductive to say that this novel is accomplishing something? And if so, you know, are the individual moments that we spend with it valuable enough to say that, you know, all of them belong? And, you know, this is a little bit of a kind of a reflection on the device itself. Is the device working with the rest of the novel, or once we kind of get used to the device, is there not much more to take from this novel?
Well, that makes me think of two things, two comments I might make. The first is that, I mean, the story of work is the story of distraction, right? Like, the experience of working, at least for, you know, contemporary white-collar Americans, the experience of work is essentially like the push and pull between focus and distraction. Like, that is the kind of core, that's like the core mental mechanic of working, is finding a space between distraction and the ostensible task where you can get enough done on the ostensible task to, you know, defensibly say that you've worked while still indulging distraction enough to maintain your own sanity and your sense of yourself as an individual, right? So it seems thematically reasonable to me that it would have a distractible structure. You know, like the first, everything up until we shift into Lynn Mason's POV is, as much as anything, like a bunch of people continually battling distraction, and it's kind of form recapitulating content if the structure feels like a series of distractions. And I mean, I think also, you know, there are basically two, from a plot standpoint, there are really only, well, three things that happen in this novel, right? The advertising firm hemorrhages clients and money and employees. Lynn Mason gets breast cancer, and Tom Moda comes back and stages an active shooter event with a paintball gun, right? And two of those are kind of, you can essentially divide this novel into thirds, right? There's the first third, which is everybody kind of, you know, in a state of sort of floaty distractiveness and lots of that we device. And then the middle third, which is Lynn Mason's POV. And then the last third, which is people's individual POVs during Tom Moda's shooting. And in some sense, the idea of the shooting, I mean, Tom is never super overt about what he's trying to achieve with the faux shooting, right? But I mean, the subtext, I assume, is that he is trying to reconnect people with, even if he never says so openly, like, why would you do something like that, make everybody think they're about to die in an active shooter event? Because you're trying to reconnect them with some core sense of identity and who they are and what matters, right? I mean, that is in some way a matter of peeling back distraction, removing the dross of distraction that prevents us from seeing. And Lynn Mason's cancer kind of has an inverse of that, right? Where, you know, Tom's shooting is a bunch of people facing death and thinking, I wish I wasn't at work, right? And Lynn's cancer is one person facing death and thinking, all I have in my life is work, and I wish I was at my partner's work watching him walk around working, right? Or, you know, my ex-boyfriend's work, watching him walk around working. So in some sense, like, the first third of the novel is a bunch of people in a world of distraction. And then the second and third thirds are either somebody understanding that everything other than work is a distraction, or a group of people halfway understanding that work is a distraction from what's important to them, but not really being able to shed it, something like that. So again, I mean, if you think of the second person narrator or the book's focus as being distractible, or as kind of accruing semi-necessary things through a kind of process of continual narrative distractibility, that seems thematically quite effective. And if you pared that back enough that it was less bothersome, it might also be less thematically effective. That might also, everything I just said might be bullshit also. I'm not incredibly committed to any of the points I just made.
Well, I want to follow up with you, and then I do want to kind of turn to the capitalism question that Patrick brought up earlier and tie that to his appreciation of the novel. But when you said you were moved by the last, 10 pages of Then We Came to the End, it actually didn't occur to me until that moment how much this is resonant with our experience of returning and or not returning to the office right now. Like, this is an interesting post-pandemic read.
Yes.
Because the capitalist critique is sort of complicated by the fact that this we is a we because it's together. And there is a warmth, even with all of the sniping and teasing that these creatives do to each other, inflict upon each other. There's a kind of familial warmth there that I found moving too, but I didn't connect it to reading it now. And is there something to reading it now I won't phrase that as a question. I'll say that reading it now, I was missing that. I was missing that sense of, even if it is a kind of suffering to work, it was shared suffering and the relationships that kind of emerge there and the reliability of knowing that you weren't alone and knowing that you were close to other people who were kind of going through, if not exactly the same struggles, at least they were comparable and you could kind of connect through that one office over.
Yeah, I thought about that too. I was going to bring that up actually during the initial responses part, but we just got distracted by other things. But yeah, I mean, there is maybe a poignance that comes to this novel now from being to some extent a document of a way of life that, if it's not vanished, is, I think, going to be much rarer in the future, right? I mean, my own workplace Post-pandemic, I mean, there is some in-person work, but it's shifted to a much more hybrid model where most people are 60 or 70% remote. And yeah, I mean, there's a paradox to it, right? And maybe this is all too extra textual. I apologize if I'm not talking enough about the actual novel, but like, there's a paradox where I don't want to have to go back to the office every day, but I sort of wish everybody else was there whenever I was there, you know? And for all the time that I've had a white-collar office job, I hope nobody that I work with listens to this, but probably they won't. But for most of the time that I've had a white-collar office job, I've actively disliked, at the very least actively disliked, if not hated, 80 to 90% of all the people around me, you know. But I've still managed to end up with some very strong and enduring friendships and relationships. And for most of that period, would have been ultimately probably a much more isolated, unhappy person without the connections that I'd had if I had gone through the same 7 years of white-collar office work primarily in a remote setting, you know? And so Americans are so... Contemporary Americans have so little sense of community, right? And probably contemporary Westerners, but I'm only experienced with the U.S., but contemporary Americans are so isolated anyway compared to most people most other times. And while I recognize that from a lot of standpoints, you know, the move to a greater amount of hybrid work or remote work is beneficial, I was aware of that loss while reading this novel, and that's probably where some of my emotional response to the end of it came from.
Patrick, I was kind of pleasantly surprised to hear. I didn't hear you say necessarily that you love this novel, but that you responded to it despite its meta play, its lack of a commitment to communicating a didactic opinion about the workplace and what happens there. You liked this novel, but you weren't in love with it, right?
I would say, yeah, I enjoyed this. It's not gonna, like, you know, didn't shake me to my core or, you know, like, earn, like, a special place in my head where I keep all the books that have really changed me or really affected me. But yeah, as an enjoyable read, I thought it was pretty, pretty good, you know, likable, like, yeah.
It's kind of hard to write questions for this novel because the characters, other than Lynn Mason, don't really stand out. The conflict is not. Right. It's this book, in thinking about it, it feels... It's a very, very nice sort of capture of what it's like to be in the office. It's hard to abstract that out into any, like, questions.
Yeah, I think that's probably true of any novel that's episodic or that is... kind of loose in the way this one is. Like, certainly there are like episodes that you enjoy, that you find interesting. Like, I really liked the towards the beginning where is it Tom Moda? No, it's not Tom. It's what the heck was that guy's name? I forget, but like he's terrified that he's going to get laid off because the office administrator is freaking out that he took a chair.
Chris Yop.
Yeah. And then later, Lynn does let him go, but it's not about the chair. And, like, the pettiness of the office administrator, the kind of inhuman way in which she just inquires after these things, like, it doesn't matter that, like, Chris could lose his you know, ability to care for himself and his family. That, you know, I liked that, but and that's like an area where, like, the didacticism could have been ratcheted up. Like, if we had wanted to, you know, really explore the injustice of the employer-employee relationship, we could have done more things like that. So, I don't know if I have a deeper comment than that, other than, like, it could have done certain things, and it chose not to do those things, and that's okay. It was still fairly enjoyable.
Yeah, I wonder...
go ahead, Hans.
Sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead, Chris.
Well, I was going to say that Chris Yap is one of the... there's a quote that I marked in the novel, and it is in regards to not Chris Yarp taking the chair, Yop taking the chair, but Marcia taking, taken somebody else's chair. Throughout the novel, there's this threaded confusion about who's taking whose chairs after a person has been let go. And Marcia is worried because Chris Yap has been fired, that now she's going to be fired because she stole somebody else's chair. And the "we" here says, "We told her to get a hold of herself, Chris Yap. We told her to get a hold of herself. Chris Yap was not let go just because he was caught with Tom Moda's bookshelves. He was let go because he can't even drop his own resume without filling it with typos. Lynn Mason and the other partners couldn't trust million-dollar ad campaigns to sloppy copywriters. That is, if we ever had million-dollar ad campaigns again. That's why Chris Yap was let go." And that kind of contradicts a point that another character in the novel makes, Old Briz, who explains that really who's let go and who's kept has very little to do with that person's actual value. And this was just an interesting little knot of differing opinions that seemed to silhouette this idea of the stories that people who keep their jobs when there are layoffs tell themselves to sort of rationalize why they are still there. We're still here because we deserve it, right? And that's may or may not be true in some, you know, individual case. But collectively, ultimately, everyone loses their jobs here. And the point that Old Briz makes is that their individual values are not... Their individual value and what they bring to the company is not reflected in really in whether they get to keep their job or not. And I thought that was... a kind of a little seed crystal of a critique that's not really built upon, but I liked that it was there, and that was part of that unreliable narrator thing too, which is the ongoing rationalization of the "we" to kind of like make peace with the fact that this entire firm is going down around them.
Sure.
Yeah, I suppose ultimately, as far as like to what extent and to how much this is or could have been a critique of capitalism, I think ultimately the it would be a much stronger critique if they didn't all ultimately land on their feet. Right. I mean, everybody, I guess with the possible exception of Tom Moda, who probably was not going to do well anyway, right? Like, the firm collapses, people are let go regardless of their value. But 5 years later, they've all essentially rebounded, right? They've all kind of come back to where they were, and they're all they're all continuing to function within, they're continuing to function in relative comfort within the system as it's been constructed for them. And, you know, if the firm's lack of care for individual well-being, or kind of ultimate inability to care for individual well-being, caused more traumatic things, then, you know, maybe that ending would come off as more critical. It is interesting that we haven't discussed the worst thing that happens in the novel at all that I can think of, right? Like, there's a character whose child is abducted and murdered, and that's, I mean, vastly, vastly more horrifying than anything else. And it's a plot point, and it, you know, the characters respond to that with some attempt at compassion and dignity, but ultimately, you know, in a world where everything was given its appropriate weight and emphasis, the story couldn't actually be about anything other than this woman's 9-year-old daughter being abducted and murdered, mm-hmm. right? But in fact, it occupies about 5% of the space of the novel. And it's not ignored, but it's also not allowed to eclipse everything else in the way that you would kind of expect it to. I guess if anything, and I mean, if there is a critique there, it's a very underplayed critique, but maybe that is in fact a subtle critique that we've missed.
Right.
Yeah, the Janine's daughter's murder is used primarily as a, there's a couple moments where it's used to kind of humanize Tom Moda or a couple of the other people in the novel. But it's also used quite a bit to actually platform a few jokes. Not at Janine's expense usually, but Janine is found to be the mother who works at this firm is found to be visiting McDonald's daily, the ball pit, and submerging herself in the ball pit as a way of basically dealing with the death of her child. Also, we get a scene very early on of the creatives coming together to create missing posters for the girl when she's missing and not found dead. And there is a kind of a scene, a protracted scene, where they're kind of quibbling about how to make the kid look good in Photoshop for the missing poster, which is a kind of cartoony way of using this tragedy to make fun of these people. I'm glad you brought that up, Hans, because that does feel a little bit it's a tragedy, but, and you say it's a plot point, but nothing material changes because Janine's daughter is dead. It's just something that happens to the side.
You can very, very easily imagine a version of this novel in which Janine just doesn't exist. Janine and her daughter don't exist as a character, right? I don't think it would change much of anything about the novel. Whereas if you removed Tom Moda or Lynn, it, you know, the whole thing would fall apart, right? Like those, it doesn't feel to me like a keystone, which is interesting because it's more conventionally dramatic than anything else in the book. I don't know if that's thematic or just, you know, I don't know if I'm making a craft criticism or if I'm observing a thematic I don't know if I'm criticizing craft or observing theme. I truly don't, actually.
Is it Calvin Ball to ask you how you would, if you were writing this novel, how you would use Janine and her child's murder in this story? It happens really early. Most of what we're talking about takes place before the majority of the sequence of events of the novel in 2001 take place. A lot of it is casting back from that, from a few day span or like a several week span in 2001, when leading up to Tom Moda showing up and pretending to shoot everybody. So Janine's daughter's murder has happened before a lot of the present tense of the novel takes place. Is it Calvin Ball to ask how you would use that? Or you don't have to answer that if you feel like it doesn't really go anywhere.
I'm happy to answer it. If I were writing this novel, I just wouldn't create that character. It's too much. It's too much. If I had the idea to create that character, I would think, well, this is too much for what I'm trying to do. This doesn't fit here, you know? I just wouldn't. You mentioned humanizing Tom Moda. There's a sequence where he uses his paintball gun to paint over the billboard with the missing daughter once she is discovered to be dead, and the billboard is a source of constant suffering for Janine. Rereading this a second time, the first time I read this, when the massacre at the end turned out to just be a paintball gun, I thought, well, that's a little bit of a cop-out. Reading it a second time, knowing what was coming, that scene is much more relevant because that is a much clearer signaling that A, Tom's a good guy, and B, the only gun he owns is a paintball gun. So the rug pull that, oh, actually it's just paint, like that felt more organic. So I guess it serves that that plot point structurally, but I just don't think that I would. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it fits with the register here. Like it's out of key enough with the overall register that either the mismatch is thematically significant or it's just not a good craft decision. I have to think it's one of those two things. So I just wouldn't have introduced it, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think that's a really, for the most emotionally fraught, the most emotionally weighty element of the novel to be used kind of repeatedly as a device for manipulating funny scenes or humanizing complicated characters. I think that is a kind of a fair criticism. Not to get kind of woke and cancel-y about it. It's just that it is sort of sad that Janine and her daughter are reduced to that kind of work in this novel.
I don't know. Maybe I'm being too hard on it. I guess, I don't know. I mean, my assumption is that if somebody I worked with had that experience, it would be of such gravity that it would somehow change everything and we couldn't go on as we've gone on. But that's probably not true, right? Maybe the fact that it's not of such gravity and they do go on as they've gone on, maybe that is a critique because it suggests ultimately the environment and the people's response to it can't really change, right?
Well, you mentioned earlier that Janine might indicate a critique that we haven't really explored yet. That would be what it is, right? The fact that things continue on in the way that they have always done You know, that's the critique of the machinery of business, right? Like, it doesn't really matter what's going on in your life. It doesn't matter if your child has been abducted and killed. You know, money keeps moving, goods are still exchanged, and you simply have to keep, if you either stay on the side of money moving and exchanging, or, you know, you disappear, you go away.
And what do you do if you are those people, you know? I mean, they make some kind of reasonable effort to assist in the search, but, I mean, once
right.
the daughter's dead, what do you do, right? I mean, the most that you can do is just tell Janine, well, we'll keep paying you whether you come to work or not, but I don't know, that might not even ultimately be good for her, you know? So, I don't
well,
know,
you certainly
maybe...
Don't.
The okay. powerlessness, I mean, the point, I guess, is just, you know, there's a level of powerlessness that you're going to feel. Maybe part of the critique is that if, you know, if this were a church, if this office were a church and not an office, it would have something to say about bigger questions that allowed the possibility of genuine comfort or the ability to find some kind of transformative way to understand and experience this tragedy, right? Even if it were a political party, right? Of all the forms of a we, this is the form of we-ness that is least equipped to make the form of we-ness that is least equipped to offer anything helpful. And maybe that is the
Sure. And it's also the most common we that we find ourselves in.
Right, exactly.
Interesting. I like that idea.
That's a good segue into my last question about we stories. I don't know of any other first-person plural stories. This story, Then We Came to the End, captures the zeitgeist of an office. Specifically in office during the crash after the dot-com boom. And that is interesting because it allows us to explore and experience a lot of the silly and warm and human and nasty and petty things that sort of get captured by that zeitgeist, by that pluralistic viewpoint at that time in that setting. Are there other stories out there that could be told from a we perspective that, or is this kind of a one-trick pony? I don't know of any other stories like this. So that's maybe you guys know of others.
A Rose for Emily by Faulkner, isn't that all collective first person?
I've never read it.
It's been years and years since I read it. My memory is that it's collective first person, right? And the it's about the town's failure to the town's collective failure to essentially like be good to Emily, for lack of a better way to put it. I should have reread that in preparation for this podcast because it is the only other thing I can think of that is in second person plural, if I'm remembering correctly that it is. I'm pulling up the text of it here, but I mean obviously I can't just I you know, can't just read the whole thing right now on the spot, I don't think. Yes, it is. Actually, I'm looking at it now, and yeah, A Rose for Emily is all narrated by a we.
Is that a Is that a trick or a device that, I guess, Then We Came to the End, when it came out, did get a lot of attention, and it was, I think, just within a few years, Hans, we were in graduate school and we were reading it. So it must have gotten enough attention to merit that kind of addition to the curriculum. Is it something that that is valuable for unlocking stories that we couldn't tell otherwise, or is it more spectacle and beyond its use every now and then not very interesting?
It must not be. I'm going to take a very pragmatic approach and say that it must not have much potential, or it would have been used. I'm going to assume that just, you know, from a Darwinian perspective, it wouldn't just be sitting there on the table if there were more that could be done with it. I think it might just be because the first and third person are powerful enough as tools that there's almost nothing one would try to do with a novel that could not be achieved either with the first or third. Sorry, go ahead, Patrick.
Well, I think I was just going to put two and two together. So I've never read A Rose for Emily. I have read some Faulkner, but not a lot. He's a writer I've always been meaning to get more into, but it seems you said that A Rose for Emily is about a town that is trying to come to grips with the fact that it has treated Emily very poorly. So it seems like both A Rose for Emily and this novel are told from, in using the we, they're told from the perspective of a given community, right? So it seems like that is what the we would have to do. You know, if you're gonna tell a story from first person plural perspective, then you have to represent the entire community that belonged to the we. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got the fact that first person singular and third person singular are already very powerful, and the fact that we has to represent a community, so that's a limitation. So that would play into your Darwinian explanation.
A few years ago, I don't know if you guys all remember this, we had, Patrick, you organized a video discussion, which was essentially one of the precursors of what it eventually kind of stabilized itself in format and personnel as this podcast, right? And there was a video discussion that you coordinated about genre versus literary fiction with a few people that we had gone to grad school with. And one of those people, John Fletcher, was making points about the, I'm probably going to grotesquely distort what he was trying to say, but he was making points about the, his point, as I understood it, was there was a, the kind of, the way that Western fiction emphasizes individual perspective was somehow corrosive, destructive. And I never really understood what he could possibly conceive of as an alternative, right? Maybe fiction narrated by a collective is some kind of alternative possibly to what he perceived as the philosophically destructive effect of the first person or third person viewpoint.
Maybe. I do. I mean, I think that's a good characterization of his position, at least back then. I remember shortly after that video discussion we had, he sent me the draft of a critical book that he had been working on, in which he essentially defended the thesis that the introduction of the narrative self in 18th century British literature was deeply problematic. And, you know, the book, his thesis was very, I think the word I'm looking for is inimical, or maybe not, maybe that's not the right, but it was very hostile to the idea, the very fundamental idea that most Western people have, that they are kind of the center, you know, they're essentially the main character in their own story. And you know, I don't know if I have anything more to say about that other than I think that's a reasonable explanation of his position, and it was interesting, and I don't know if I agree with it, but it does seem like he, you know, community stories would be a possible alternative to literature that is always focused on the main character or the protagonist. The only other option would seem to be community stories. Now, I don't think that this novel, Then We Came to an End, would actually work to be an alternative, because, you know, it's told from the perspective of the creatives, but, you know, it still breaks down to talk about individual stories and you know, situates people at the center of various perspectives, you know, dealing with their own pain and their own problems. So I don't know if this is a good alternative. I would think that maybe good alternatives would be something more like creation stories, where, you know, in an attempt to explain some type of phenomenon, you know, you have a, you know, you have a series of metaphorical actions that attempt to explain how something comes to be. Like, you know, the reason that the rabbit has a big white tail is because Frith wanted to punish the rabbit for
arrogance.
His arrogance. Yeah. His arrogance, right? So he's like, here, you have a big white tail now. Like, all the foxes and the weasels and whatnot are gonna get you. And that way, like, the rabbit is representative of all rabbits, and the rabbit who is constantly trying to avoid predators, that is common to all rabbits, right? So maybe that's an alternative. I don't know. Like, I'm just shooting the.
Sure.
Ideas out.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, I don't know. I find it utterly impossible to conceive an alternative, right? And any possible alternative, I can't imagine how any possible alternative doesn't end up just like a shallow reskin of the thing that it's trying to be an alternative to, right? I mean, like the creation stories that you've talked about in practice, like, of course, the rabbit is a character with an individual narrative, right? And
right.
But I mean, it might be that my inability to conceive of an alternative is just a product of my consciousness being so rooted in slash corrupted by the problem that is being spotlighted. If, I mean, to tie it back to the core subject, this is ultimately, I mean, the second person narrator, functionally speaking, you could lightly rewrite the novel and make it universally third person, remove the device of the second person narrator. You might have a slightly less interesting novel, but you wouldn't fundamentally change the bones of what it is or what it's doing.
Right. Sure.
On that note, who is choosing our next? Is it Hans?
Me, I believe. Yeah. So I'm very sorry, Chris. My pick is actually much more a response to Patrick's last pick. I just... there was nothing in this book that resonated me with other books that I wanted to pursue. But Patrick, I was thinking about, you know, when we were going through Eiffelheim a couple episodes ago, we were talking about communication and what I characterized then as the scientific mindset's habitual optimism about the possibility of communication, right? Or the idea scientific... So I was thinking about that idea, and there's a book I've been meaning to read for a bit that seems to me like a very interesting counter to that, if I'm understanding the idea of this book correctly. I have not read this yet, which is rare for things I pick for the podcast. I almost always pick things that I've already read. But my pick for the next episode is When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut.
Okay, cool.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll catch you next with When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut.
Close enough. And, I don't really know how it's pronounced.
I have that pulled up. Labatut.
Labiatit.
Patrick.
That's what it said.
Yeah, all right. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Peace out.
Bye, guys. Everyone.